It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a stay that allows the abortion drug mifepristone to remain on the market. A law professor helps us understand the case and where it goes from here. First, 16-year-old Ralph Jarl was shot in the head and the arm when he went to pick up his younger twin brothers on April 13th. He mistakenly went to 115th Street instead of 115th Terrace in Kansas City, Missouri. 2 days later, April 15th, 20-year-old Kaylin Gillis was shot and killed after pulling into the wrong driveway in rural upstate New York. On that same day in South Florida, an 18 and 19-year-old were shot at after trying to deliver groceries and pulling into the driveway next door to their destination. Last Monday, two high school cheerleaders were shot after one of the girls accidentally tried to get into the wrong car outside of Austin, Texas. And last Tuesday, a man in North Carolina shot at a 6-year-old and other family members after a basketball rolled into his yard and neighbors came to retrieve it. Charges have been filed in most of those incidents. The string of shootings of apparently non-threatening people has raised questions about U.S. and state laws on self-defense, as well as things like stand your ground and castle doctrine laws. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the string of shootings you may have seen in the news? Do you have questions about what does and doesn't constitute self-defense under federal or state law? Where do you think that line should be drawn? Do you worry about your kids' safety, say, if they get lost or show up at the wrong place? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. John Gross is a clinical associate professor of law at the UW Law School and director of the Public Defender Project. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. It's my pleasure to be here.
Now, it's kind of tricky to talk about all these different incidents. They'll have their own way through court as allegations are dealt with. But big picture, John, it seems like these cases, as they're being described in the media, go beyond what we would consider, what the law would consider self-defense. Do I have that right?
Yes. These cases go way beyond what the law would traditionally recognize as self-defense. And I think all of them have kind of one thing in common, which is that there really is no perceived threat, certainly no imminent threat to the people who are resorting to deadly force.
Right. The notion that, okay, somebody is on my front lawn or at my front door or pulling up my driveway, triggering, sorry to use the word, but leading to me shooting at them, that under any law, I think in any state, that alone wouldn't constitute an argument of self-defense?
That's correct. You're really never allowed to use deadly force to protect property. And in all of these cases, the best argument that someone has is that the person was somehow trespassing on their property. And that's not treated the same as, you know, a physical threat of violence. And so you really don't have the right to use deadly force unless you reasonably believe someone is about to use deadly force against you.
Let's talk about some of the self-defense laws around the country. Let's start here in Wisconsin. What we hear phrases like stand your ground and castle doctrine and duty to retreat. What is in place here in Wisconsin?
So Wisconsin does not have a stand your ground law, and Wisconsin does not also have an explicit duty to retreat. And just so people understand, right, the law of self-defense grew up around this idea that if you could retreat from a situation, then you were not entitled to use deadly force. If you could avoid using deadly force and still safely remove yourself from a situation where you felt threatened, you should do that. The one exception to that traditionally has been what the law called the castle doctrine, which refers to your home being your castle. And it says that if you are in your home, or you come into your home and you see an intruder there, or someone is attempting to break into your home, you don't have to leave the home. You can stay in your home and use deadly force. And the touchstone in Wisconsin for use of force is the reasonableness of the force in relationship to the threat that you perceive. And also, when we talk about deadly force, the law says that you can use deadly force to prevent great bodily harm or death to yourself, but it has to be to prevent imminent death or great bodily harm. And that's the word that the statute that uses, imminent. So it can't be I might be under threat. It has to be a reasonable belief that you are in imminent danger of death or serious bodily harm.
I know with when it comes to the police use of force, there are Supreme Court set standards on that sort of reasonable perception. And some of that can feel a little subjective. In what instance could that officer in that instance feel that there was a legitimate threat here? How much does self-perception of a threat? Well, it may not have looked like it to an outside observer, but I felt threatened as a person claiming self-defense.
So the standard really relies on that the reasonableness of that subjective belief. And we can imagine situations where people might have a reasonable belief that someone is about to harm them, maybe even seriously harm them, even if they haven't yet seen the person brandishing a weapon. So an example I like to give about this, if someone has previously threatened you, they've threatened to kill you, they show up outside of your place of employment and reach into their pocket as if they were going to draw out a gun and shoot you, at that point, you might be reasonable for you to think, I need to use deadly force to defend myself. So it's a very case-by-case specific analysis. But you know, again, a touchstone really here is that it has to be a reasonable belief, and the perceived threat does have to be imminent.
Talking to John Gross with UW Law School, looking at self-defense, the laws around the country where they do and don't apply. After a series that I listed earlier of events over the last couple weeks, people shot for accidentally showing up on a different doorstep than they'd meant to, or in a different driveway than they'd meant to. You can join in with your thoughts or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. John, you mentioned the Castle Doctrine, which is in effect in Wisconsin. One that isn't, and I throw out the phrase here, stand your ground laws of Florida passed, I believe, the first one in the country in 2005. What does that mean?
So stand your ground laws typically refer to a statute that changes the law regarding self-defense in that it removes a duty to retreat when you are in a public space. So again, the traditional law was, we don't want you to resort to deadly force if you can safely withdraw from a situation and not use deadly force. The one exception is when we're talking about your home. The stand your ground laws essentially say, if you are somewhere where you are legally entitled to be, you can use deadly force and there is no obligation for you to retreat, even if you could safely retreat. And so I think a legitimate criticism of these laws is that it really authorizes people to use deadly force in a situation where it's simply not necessary that they do so. And that has led, I think, to some very high profile cases of people resorting to deadly force when there's a legitimate question about whether or not they just could have shown the person they had a gun and walked away from the situation. And so stand your ground. The essence of the stand your ground law is there, those states that adopt them are removing any duty to retreat, even if it's safe for you to do so.
John, I've spent enough time in bars to see angry disputes that you could envision escalating outside the bar to a point where each side, each participant feels that they are under threat, and each participant could claim self-defense if they escalated the violence further under a stand your ground type law. Is that a concern?
It's very much a concern. I mean, I think the law naturally developed with this idea that you should try to retreat. And the law did that because the law says, in the eyes of the law, right, the preservation of human life is extremely important. And so we don't want to encourage people to resort to deadly violence unless they really feel like there's an imminent threat to their own safety. And so to some degree, these stand your ground laws kind of encourage people to reach for a gun when cooler heads should really prevail.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm so glad you're talking about this. I have weapons training. Madison West Girls Rifle Club in the 60s, and also I've been burglarized at least twice, living in New York City. And the conflict I see between the castle theory and self protection, everything, is if a burglar is entering your home when you're there, and you have the double goal of keeping your family safe, what are you going to do? Oh, excuse me, Mr. Burglar, if you can give me like 3 minutes, I'll go and find my key and unlock the drawer that my pistol is in so I can defend myself. You know, I have to keep it safe from the children. To my mind, you're much more in danger of having your own family injured with your own pistol than from a burglar.
Okay, thanks for the call, Kay, from some personal experience there. John raising a lot of the, ambivalence people might feel about having a gun in the home for self-defense.
Yeah, I mean, the statistics show that, people are far more likely to commit suicide with a gun than they are to commit a homicide with the gun. And so we do have an enormous problem in the country about self-harm with firearms. And so there really is, a lot of questions as the caller raises about, does having the firearm in your home really make you safer overall?
Okay, thanks for the call. We're talking to John Gross, Clinical Associate Professor of Law at the UW Law School, Director there of the Public Defender Project, talking about the recent cases around the country of young people being shot after mistakenly entering someone's property without presenting an obvious threat. And looking at self-defense laws in Wisconsin and around the country, what they do and don't allow, you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with John Gross, Clinical Associate Professor of Law at the University of Wisconsin Law School and Director of the Public Defender Project. Looking at recent stories of young people being shot or shot at after pulling into the wrong driveway, ringing the wrong doorbell, or opening the wrong car door. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions to that string of stories, your questions or thoughts on the current state of self-defense laws here in Wisconsin and around the country. We'll go back to your calls now. Michael is with us in Spring Green. Michael, hi.
Hi. I've got a question for your guest. To get a concealed carry weapon, you have to take a safety course. And in that course, there are a lot of issues that are brought up that help one really understand the power of a gun and the power of when and when not to use it. Do you think that requiring everyone, regardless of what kind of gun they buy, to have a course would be a good idea?
Even for people who don't get a concealed carry permit, Michael, I gotcha. John, what do you think?
I definitely think that's a good idea. I mean, I think that just speaks to, you're talking about, people having lethal weapons. Semi-automatic handguns can fire, even in untrained hands, they can fire, multiple bullets in a second. We, of course, make people get licenses to drive motor vehicles because motor vehicles are potentially dangerous and can take a life. And so I think it would be reasonable to also say if anybody wants to exercise their right and purchase a gun or carry a gun, there should be some basic safety and training associated with that.
Thanks a lot for that call, Michael. Mark joins us now in De Pere. Mark, hi.
Hello, my name's Mark. I was once walking along the shoreline where the water laps the sand on a county park just outside a county park along Lake Michigan, and one of the people in one of the houses walked out with a shotgun, saying that I was trespassing and that it threatened me. And so I obviously went back off their property. But am I actually trespassing when I'm walking at that place where the water meets the land?
Mark, thanks for the call. John, I believe people have access to that. That's a whole different class of law. But enforcing a perceived trespassing law with a shotgun, that does fit into our conversation, I think.
Yeah, it does. And as I mentioned earlier, you're not entitled to use deadly force to protect property. It's seen as unreasonable to do so, because while property might be damaged or even destroyed, it can be replaced. Somebody's life cannot be replaced. And so trespasses on property or even destruction of property. If somebody were to come into your driveway and, hit your car, with a hammer, you're not allowed to shoot them. They're not directing a threat to your personal safety. And so the law says that's an unreasonable way of enforcing a property right to take someone's life.
Thanks for the call, Mark, and sharing that scary experience. Martin joins us now in Duluth. Martin, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have two questions. The first question is, if the police come to your door and they don't have a warrant, and you open the door, which maybe you shouldn't, but you open the door to talk to them, and then they put their foot inside the house where you can't shut it, and that would make me frightened. What do you do in that sort of situation?
John, thanks for the call. I'm guessing this would not be a case where you would have a case for lethal force under self-defense, John.
No, you would not. And I think that there's an important distinction here about regarding law enforcement. And even if you perceive law enforcement to be violating one of your rights, if you think law enforcement has illegally entered your property, if you think they've illegally detained you, you can't use force against law enforcement officers. You have other remedies. You can file a civil lawsuit against them for a violation of your civil rights. But the law does not allow you to resist even what you might legitimately believe is an unlawful use of police force with force against those officers. That would be a crime.
Thanks for the call. Ryan joins us now in Amory. Ryan, hello.
Hi. I think that these laws are just dripping with racism. The practical effect is certainly that white people can stand their ground and black people can't. It is so unjust. I asked Philando Castile about stand your ground jobs, stand your ground. He was an NRA member in St. Paul that told an officer he had a gun. The officer instinctively shot him and killed him.
Ryan, thanks for the call. John, have you looked at or thought about the racial implications of our self-defense laws?
There is absolutely the potential for not just explicit racial bias, but implicit racial bias, because the law talks about somebody's reasonable perceptions, right? And so if somebody, because of racism in society, if not a specifically held racist belief, but just an implicit bias toward people of color, perceiving them as more threatening, and if jurors feel that way as well, you have the potential to excuse the use of deadly force against people in society based on racism. And I have to say too, there's a long history of firearms regulation specifically tailored to political groups, including the Black Panthers, who sought to arm themselves and saw a backlash against the use and access of firearms because they were suddenly in the hands of people of color. And that prompted a wave of regulation of firearms back in the 60s and 70s. Of course, since then, we've had a much more loosening of those regulations, which leads to the kind of proliferation of guns that we have in the country now.
Thanks for that call, Ryan. Dante is with us now in Green Bay. Dante, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. I was wondering, do stand your ground laws or self-defense, do they still count if you initiated a physical altercation? Let's say you were angry, you got in a fight. Now you're in a fight you can't win, and now you got to shoot your way out of it. Do those laws still apply?
Dante, thanks for the call. Yeah, can I claim self-defense if I started the physical altercation in the first place, John?
Yeah, that's a great question. And in fact, in Wisconsin, like in many other states, one of the factors that goes into evaluating whether or not you had a right to use self-defense was whether or not you provoked the encounter. And the law basically is if you did provoke the other person, if you did something that was illegal, right, and was likely to provoke them to attack you or get in a physical confrontation with you, you can't claim self-defense. You can't claim use of deadly force unless you have exhausted every opportunity to retreat from that situation. So yes, provocation does impact whether or not the law is going to recognize your right to use deadly force.
Thanks for that call. John, in just our last minute here, again, I listed those five different incidents over the course of just 1 week this month. Are you concerned that people are looking at our self-defense laws, misperceiving them, misconstruing them, and reaching for that gun way sooner than the law would allow as a result?
I mean, these recent cases certainly make the case for that argument. I mean, I think people may not understand when they are entitled to use self-defense. They may be confusing the laws of different states. They may also just be a situation where people are increasingly marginalized and engaging in less social interaction. I mean, I can't help but be old enough to remember when sometimes you had to stop and ask someone for directions. Now we have GPS, and so pulling into the wrong driveway is perceived as a threat by some people. But yes, I mean, I think these incidents highlight that people should be hesitating to use deadly force, not embracing the idea they have the right to use it.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's John Gross, Clinical Associate Professor of Law at the UW Law School and Director of the Public Defender Project. He joined us with a look at self-defense laws here in Wisconsin and around the country, following a number of recent stories of young people being shot when they mistakenly approached the wrong house or vehicle. Coming up after the news, the law professor breaks down the U.S. Supreme Court's action on the abortion pill, mifepristone, and the next steps in the legal case. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we still can't swear on the radio, but in some workplaces, cursing seems to be getting more common. We'll talk to a leading expert on curse words about how norms are changing. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court blocked lower court rulings on Friday on the abortion drug mifepristone. Those rulings aim to overturn the FDA's approval of the abortion medication or at least more recent changes to FDA guidelines on the use of the drug. The Supreme Court's action means the drug remains widely available, but the case moves back to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals to issue a ruling in the future. It all comes from a federal lawsuit in Texas, where an anti-abortion group argued that the FDA improperly approved the medication back in 2000. The drug remains mostly illegal here in Wisconsin, given the state's near-total abortion ban that came back into effect after last year's Dobbs ruling. We're learning more about what the court rulings mean and where the legal battle could go from here, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about this series of court decisions or the laws involving mifepristone? How do you feel about the U.S. Supreme Court, at least for now, maintaining access to that medication? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. David S. Cohen is a professor at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law. He's author of the book Obstacle Course, The Everyday Struggle to Get an Abortion in America. David, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
All right, we have this action from the U.S. Supreme Court, but it doesn't seem to end this story for now. What did we actually see out of the U.S. Supreme Court on this?
So this case is in the very early stages, and basically what the trial court had done was say, even though it's early on in this case, we haven't had a full trial, I'm going to put the FDA approval of this drug on hold. And that happened 2.5 weeks ago. He was going to put the approval on hold while the trial played out. And so it was these were emergency appeals from that preliminary order. And the appeals court in Texas originally said, well, you can do that. You can put the approval on hold with respect to changes, new changes with the drug. And the Supreme Court just put his entire decision on hold last week, our Friday night. They basically said, let this case play out, but we're going to keep this drug available and on the market and approved while this case plays out. So it's all preliminary. We still have to have this case go through the whole works now.
How normal or unusual is it for a judge at that point in a lawsuit like this to say, looking ahead, we're gonna take this off the market for now while this trial goes on? How common is that?
Everything about this case is very unusual, starting with the initial, the request from the plaintiffs here. No federal court has ever said the FDA has improperly approved a drug without the FDA saying, we also made a mistake. This is unprecedented. This claim from the plaintiffs has never happened before with any drug. And so to have a judge say preliminarily, I agree with you, and I agree with you before we've had a full trial on this, that we're really in completely uncharted waters here.
One other unusual thing that I got to admit, I didn't quite get how unusual it was at the outset, even having talked about this on the air some, is the issue of standing. And this could feel a little obscure, but so we've got a group, it incorporated itself in Amarillo, Texas, where this judge is, of some healthcare providers, some other members. Their argument is they can sue on this, correct me if I'm wrong, they could sue on this because there's the potential that in the future, if there's a side effect of someone taking mifepristone, one of their members as a healthcare provider might have to be involved with this. And that is the possible harm here. Can you talk about that standing argument?
Yeah, it's really strange one. Now, just the idea of standing for every case in federal court, the person coming into court has to be personally injured. And they have to ask for something from the court that would fix the injury or at least compensate them for the injury. I can't go into court because you've been injured. You have to go into court. And so these doctors, they're anti-abortion doctors, and they said that because there are complications for people taking this drug, that they are forced to treat people who had procedures there or had wanted to have an abortion and they don't like abortion, or they have to complete the abortion, or there's just their practice is harmed because they have to take time away from other patients. It's a really strange claim for a bunch of reasons. One, this drug has some of the most minimal complication rates of any drug on the market. It's safer than Tylenol, Viagra, penicillin. So you would really open up any drug to be challenged because there's no perfect drug out there. Every drug has complications for some people. So you'd basically be opening up challenges to any drug. And second, I mean, if you go into emergency medicine, if you go into urgent care, this is what you do. You treat people who have complications from life, from medical procedures, from pills, from decisions that you don't agree with. That's just part of your job. And so doing something that's a normal part of your job doesn't seem like it should be enough to get you into federal court to claim that I am injured in a special way that means I can bring this lawsuit. So the standing issue was one of the many issues that made this case seem so strange.
Talking to David Cohen, professor at Drexel University's Law School, looking at the Supreme Court's stay on a ruling that would have blocked the mifepristone medication from being used all over the United States. But it's still not done. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Chris is with us in Menominee. Chris, hi.
Hi, yeah, just listening to the conversation here. I think this was no surprise to see this passing of the buck, if you will, by the Supreme Court. They don't want to touch this with a 10-foot pole. I think that with the recent scrutiny of possible ethics violations of justices, this is the last thing they wanted to fall in their lap. Passing it back to the lower courts, forcing them to make a decision, just tries to kind of a delay tactic, if you will. Eventually, they're going to have to make a decision.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. David, Chris pointing us toward the future. Now, In the normal order of things, could the U.S. Supreme Court have weighed in on the merits of this case, or were they restricted to weighing in on this stay, which had been challenged?
For now, they were limited. I mean, look, they could have done anything. They could have decided we're going to take the case right now and, you know, decide it in the next couple months. But what they did was they said, we're going to let this play out in the lower appeals court. So we have that initial order from the trial judge, Judge Kaczmarek. Now it's going to be appealed to the Fifth Circuit, the appeals court that covers Texas. That's going to happen. The oral argument for that's going to happen in mid-May. They will take however long they take to issue a decision. And then if either party is unhappy with that decision, they can appeal it to the U.S. Supreme Court, which they likely will. Someone's going to be unhappy with that ruling. And the U.S. Supreme Court will probably jump in on this case, especially if the Fifth Circuit rules against the FDA and upsets the status quo. I think we will see the Supreme Court get involved. But then even then, it won't be for another year and a half that we would get a decision, probably next June. And so the caller, I think there might be something to what the caller is saying, that the Supreme Court might want to just say, we're taking a little break from the abortion cases. They just overruled Roe v. Wade last summer. And so maybe wait another year before they get into it again and issue another monumental decision around abortion. So I think the Supreme Court could, again, address this issue, but it will be a while.
Chris, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. And David, as I understand what the U.S. Supreme Court did, this stay now keeps mifepristone on the market, and it keeps it on the market even as the Court of Appeals hears it. Do I have that right?
Yes. So the Supreme Court said that mifepristone will remain approved through the Supreme Court's final decision in this case. Now, that could mean that the Supreme Court decides not to take the case. So, the Supreme Court doesn't have to take every case that comes to it. So if the parties appeal whatever the Fifth Circuit does and the Supreme Court decides not to take the case, then the stay would end. Or the Supreme Court could take the case and the stay continues through their resolution of the case. So it really, the stay is in place. The status quo is in place until the Supreme Court next rules. Now, it's important to understand with what we're talking about here, just because mifepristone is on the market and approved doesn't mean it's available everywhere. Right. There are still 14 states, including Wisconsin, that has an abortion ban. And in those states, mifepristone would only be available for people who satisfy the exceptions to the abortion ban, which is a very small number of people, if any. So it's not available everywhere just because of the status quo ruling. It's only available when it's legal by state law.
And that's an important point. In a state like Wisconsin with an existing 1849 law on the books, this case doesn't affect that existing state law in any way. Do I have that right?
Right. So states can still, at this point in time, states are still allowed to ban abortion. And just because the pill is approved by the FDA doesn't mean that states can't ban abortion generally. And that's what we have in Wisconsin and 13 other states right now. And so in those states, this ruling doesn't change the status quo that even before this case, abortion was illegal. Same with this case.
We're talking to Drexel University law professor David Cohen about the current and future legal status of the abortion medication mifepristone following a U.S. Supreme Court decision on Friday saying it stays on the market while a lower court hears a lawsuit against the FDA over their approval of the drug. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you surprised by the original ruling in this case or the Supreme Court's action on Friday? Why or why not? What kind of access do you think people should have to mifepristone? Do you have questions about the drug or the legal battle surrounding it? Do you find this all confusing? I promise, if so, you're not alone. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with David Cohen, professor at Drexel University's Law School and author of the book Obstacle Course, The Everyday Struggle to Get an Abortion in America, looking at the U.S. Supreme Court's decision on the abortion medication mifepristone, what it means for the continuing legal fight over access to the drug. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the Supreme Court saying, yes, this drug used in abortions does stay on the market, at least for now? What questions do you have about the future or present of the lawsuit against the FDA over approval of this medication? Join in with your thoughts, your reactions, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. David, I want to talk a little bit about what's at stake. You've written about what people go through when they're seeking an abortion in the United States. Mifepristone, one of two drugs used in the United States. How important is medication abortion when it comes to abortion access? What do you see the potential impact if mifepristone were out of the equation?
At this point in time, the best data we have is that over half of the abortions in this country are done through medication. And that's a huge change over the past decade, decade and a half. And also in the past couple of years, abortion clinics have been allowed to mail pills to people. And so that means that people don't even have to go to a clinic to get an abortion. They can talk to a doctor or another medical care professional who's associated with an abortion clinic or a hospital, do all the counseling over the phone, and they can get their medical information, and then the pills can be mailed to them so they can have an abortion in the privacy of their own home. And people really seem to want that. I mean, just the numbers show that that is an appealing way for privacy reasons, but also for travel reasons. There are, you know, abortion clinics have been dwindling in this country for a long time. And so for a lot of people who live in states where there's a very small number of clinics, it takes a long time and a lot of resources to get to an abortion provider. And so because of abortion pills, people are able to get the pills by mail in states where it's legal and have an abortion in their home without having to travel. So what was at stake with this case was a method of abortion that is A, the most common, and B, really alleviates some of the problems with access that we've seen in this country with the closure of clinics, brick and mortar clinics, because people are able to get them by pills. And so that was the real threat here, that this was going after this common an accessible method of abortion. Now, it's not for everyone. A medication abortion is only up to about 10 or 11 weeks of pregnancy, and there are some complicating factors in people's medical histories that may not make them candidates for medication abortion. But for those for whom it works, it's a very accessible option.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Dale is with us in Mauston. Dale, hi.
Hi. Your guest had mentioned that mifepristone would be illegal in Wisconsin because of the state law we have regarding abortion. What if somebody wants to go out of state to get mifepristone? Are they affected? So I have kind of a general question. How is the Wisconsin law? Can that be enforced on somebody when they want to leave the border?
I gotcha, Dale. I don't know if the connection wasn't great there, David, but the idea of you got it? Okay, go for it.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the interesting and complicated questions after Roe v. Wade was overturned. When we had a baseline that abortion was legal everywhere, we didn't have to think of the types of questions that the caller raised, but now we do. So think of people in Wisconsin, right? They can drive south to Illinois, they can drive west to Minnesota and get pills or have a procedural abortion. And I think most people think that as long as you're traveling into a state and following those states, that state's laws, that you don't have to worry about your home state's laws. And that's how I think the American justice system should work. Unfortunately, it's less than clear that that's actually the rules under constitutional law. We don't really have many cases raising the question of whether a state like, say, Wisconsin can penalize one of its residents for going out of state to do something that's illegal in Wisconsin but legal elsewhere. And I think we are going to see states try to do this. I don't know if it's going to be a Wisconsin prosecutor who's going to try to do this or another state or a legislature passing a law. We did see Idaho just a few weeks ago pass a law saying that it's illegal to drive a minor to get an abortion in other states. And so I think this is going to be one of the questions we have to confront in the coming years. And it really raises some deep questions about what it means to be a country with 50 different states and different rules within each state, but also a country where people think they, you know, believe they have the right to travel. And so I think your callers really identified an important question. Under currently, there are a lot of people who do exactly what the caller asked about, who go to other states to get abortions, and that has not been challenged yet. But the anti-abortion groups know this, and it's on their radar.
Thanks a lot for that call. Talking to David Cohen from Drexel University's Law School, looking at the U.S. Supreme Court action on the abortion or a drug often used in abortion, mifepristone. Now, David, a court of appeals prior to the Supreme Court ruling reached back to something called the Comstock Act from the 1870s. I'm seeing a lot of reporting on this. Have you been following this? Why is this popping up in this particular case?
The Comstock Act is something that a lot of people learned about in history classes because it was written in 1873. So it is literally 150 years old, by an anti-vice crusader who didn't want people getting birth control, didn't want them getting anything considered obscene. And the law says that it's illegal. It's a federal law that says it's illegal to mail anything that's considered obscene, to mail birth control, or to mail anything that can cause an abortion. And this was a very successful law for about 50 years in the late 1800s, early 1900s. A lot of people went to jail, but there was a lot of backlash. And in the 1920s, 1930s, it fell out of favor and the courts started interpreting it much more narrowly. The thing is, it was never taken off the books. The birth control part was taken off the books. And the obscenity part was considered unconstitutional as a First Amendment issue. But the abortion part is still there, but it's been ignored for 100 years. Now, the anti-abortion groups are saying, well, we've got this law in the books. It doesn't matter that it's from an era where women couldn't vote and didn't have representation. This law says it's illegal to mail anything that can cause an abortion. And so they are saying that abortion pills, which some people get through the mail, like I mentioned, shouldn't be allowed because people can mail them. But their argument really has no stopping point. It would also include banning any clinic from getting surgical supplies or medical instruments, because those are through the mail or through FedEx or some comparable service. And so they're really pushing this argument as a way that they think to ban abortion nationwide, because if you can't send anything through the mail that can cause an abortion, then all abortion will shut down in this country. So it is really a big part of the strategy right now to end abortion.
Samantha from Whitehall couldn't stay on the line, but reminds us that mifepristone is used for things other than abortion. She wonders what it would mean for people who use it for other purposes, like miscarriages and some other conditions that are treated with mifepristone. If this were ruled illegal, what about people who use it for purposes other than abortion, David?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really excellent question because it's a really important part of miscarriage management in particular. And the issue is that the only thing the FDA has approved mifepristone for is abortion. Miscarriage management and other uses related to obstetric care are off-label uses. And that's totally legal, totally fine. There's a lot of off-label uses for drugs of all sorts. The problem is if the one approval goes away, if the approval for abortion goes away, then that drug could disappear completely, in which case it would not be available for these other uses. So this is a big part of this case, which is that not only would it cut off abortion medication, abortion care, it could also cut off some other forms of important obstetrical care and make people really suffer.
And briefly, David, remind us the timeline of what to watch for next in this case.
The next thing we're going to see is oral argument in the Fifth Circuit in mid-May. They can decide any time after that. I imagine it'll be relatively quick, a month or two, but I think it'll be back to the Supreme Court in the fall with a decision next year.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's David S. Cohen, professor at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law. He's authored the book Obstacle Course, The Everyday Struggle to Get an Abortion in America. He was with us today for a look at the U.S. Supreme Court's decision on the abortion medication mifepristone, keeping it on the market for now, overturning a lower court stay on the medication. And we looked ahead to where the legal battle is expected to go next. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, some school districts in Wisconsin and elsewhere are having trouble finding teachers, especially in some high-demand subject areas. Find out how schools are working to solve the problem and join the conversation with what you're seeing in your own district. Whether you're a parent, a student, a teacher, or someone who hires teachers, join the conversation about at least some level of teacher shortages in Wisconsin and beyond. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. When's the last time you tried to learn to do something new and to get good at it? Could be an art or craft, a job skill, a sport, a language. The list goes on, and it can be frustrating while you're in the midst of it, but it can be rewarding when you suddenly realize, hey, I kind of got this. Well, tomorrow on the show, the author of a new book shares some lessons he learned trying to do a bunch of new stuff, including painting, magic tricks, the piano, and more. He also learned from people who are already good at those kind of things. He has some lessons to share. We'll hear about that tomorrow, and you can get started right now. What are you learning how to do? How's it going? Have you learned any secrets about how to get good at something? Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@wpr.org, then join the conversation tomorrow afternoon. This is Central Time.